From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I live in San Rafael, California.
Chandelora.
I'm from San Jose.
Hayward, California.
Nopa.
Kind of lower Russian Hill.
I live across from El Matate in San Francisco.
Coming up, investigative reporter Aaron Glantz tells us about our new Secretary of Defense, James Mad Dog Mattis.
Marines shot at ambulances, they shot at aid workers, and at the top of all of that, the commanding general of that whole operation was General Mattis.
Then we'll examine California's recent law allowing doctors to help terminally ill patients die.
The cecil barbitol, it's powder, it's mixed with water. Upon drinking that medication, in 5 minutes, Brittany fell asleep.
Examining new rules today on Cross Currents. Stay with us. Late last month, Congress confirmed retired General James Mattis as the new U.S. Secretary of Defense. The week before, Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting published an extensive investigation into Mattis, particularly focusing on the time he was commanding general of Marines in the 2004 siege of Fallujah in Iraq. The battle is considered to be one of the bloodiest in the Iraq War, after which General Mattis was given the nickname Mad Dog. That's according to Aaron Glantz, who was also in Fallujah at the time as an unembedded journalist. I sat down with him to talk about his latest story in Reveal called Did Defense Secretary Nominee James Mattis Commit War Crimes in Iraq? I asked him first about what happened in Fallujah.
Before the Battle of Fallujah, many Iraqi people were still grateful to the U.S. military because we had gotten rid of Saddam Hussein, who was a brutal dictator. But after the Battle of Fallujah, which was broadcast live on Arabic satellite television, the entire populace turned against the U.S. military. I mean, we killed so many people, as I mentioned, that the municipal football stadium had to be turned into a graveyard. Marines shot at ambulances. They shot at aid workers. They killed women and children. I reported that they shot at refugee camps. And at the top of all of that, the commanding general of that whole operation was General Mattis. And, you know, in that battle, he was ordered to take the city, and that's how he went about it. And now that he has been nominated and confirmed by the Senate, he will be in charge of setting policy about how our military operates overseas.
So you wrote your report. It was published January 11th when he was still a nominee. Then he's confirmed by the Senate like 9 days later on Friday, the 20th. Were you surprised by the confirmation?
I was very disappointed that not only did none of this come up, but the whole question of the Iraq War did not come up. The whole question of his command of Marines during Iraq in general didn't come up. What did you learn? How would you do things differently if you were the Secretary of Defense? What do you think about the way that the U.S. military is currently carrying out the war in Afghanistan? You were removed by President Obama as the head of Central Command because he thought you were too hawkish on Iran. How do you explain that? What is your policy on Iran?
None of this came up in the hearing.
None of it. None of these questions were asked. I mean, I would have really liked the senators to ask really hard questions like the ones I asked in my story. You know, shooting at ambulances, war crime. Shooting at aid workers, war crime. You know, Marines under his command took trophy photos of the civilians they killed. War crime. You know, how does he explain that? You know, generals in other from other countries in Rwanda and Yugoslavia have been brought up on charges under this doctrine of command responsibility. We in the United States executed General Yamashita after World War II, this Japanese general whose troops did things that are very similar to what General Mattis's Marines did. I would have liked him to be asked about this. Nobody did.
To your knowledge, has he at all been held accountable for any of this or any of the Marines who as you say, committed these war crimes?
What we saw with General Mattis is that he worked repeatedly to exonerate Marines. Mm. So Haditha is probably the most famous massacre of the entire Iraq war.
Can you tell us what happened?
Yeah, this is a case in 2005 where a whole group of Marines, after one in their unit was killed in a roadside bomb, went on a killing spree, killing dozens of civilians in their homes. And this was reported by Time magazine. It caused a huge uproar. A number of Marines were brought up on charges. General Mattis, as the convening authority, ended up stepping in and dismissing charges against three of the Marines who were accused. As a result of this, the cases against a number of the other charged Marines collapsed. And finally, at the end of the day, only one person was found guilty, and it was of dereliction of duty. Hmm. He didn't serve a day in prison. So you had two dozen Iraqi civilians dead. Because of the way General Mattis oversaw the prosecution, ultimately nobody really held accountable.
You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba, and I'm sitting with Aaron Glantz from Reveal, from the Center for Investigative Reporting. So how then did we get to a point where this new image of General Mattis is like he's this anti-torture man, and he is actually a champion of the Geneva Conventions, which is exactly the opposite of what you found in your reporting? How do you think we went from this image to that image?
I mean, they could both be true, right? I mean, he is against torture. He's been very vocal about that. He is apparently very well read and has spoken out in favor of the Geneva Conventions. In the Battle of Fallujah, he was on record before the attack on Fallujah predicting that it would be a disaster, that a large numbers of civilians would be killed.
He didn't want to go in.
He didn't want to go in, right? On the other hand, once he was ordered to do this,
Geneva Conventions went out the window.
That's what it looks like, mm-hmm. right? So I would have liked to hear him explain what this means, right? Now you're not going to be the one following the orders. You're going to be the one setting the policy.
So then what kind of a Defense Department do you think we're looking at?
Well, there's an idea that we're going to rebuild the military, right? So I think that we can look under President Trump at a lot more military spending. Mm. But in terms of how are we going to fight ISIS, you know, how is this military going to be deployed against ISIS? You know, what is our military posture going to be against China? Are we going to invade and occupy another country? These are questions that the senators might have asked, right? So that we in the public could have a sense of what sort of decisions that he might make. Many members of Congress are just relieved that James Mattis, by all accounts, is a sane, intelligent person, right? I mean, General Flynn, who's going to be our national security advisor, has written in his book that ISIS wants to kill us all and drink our blood. Right. So they're looking at, on the one hand, this general who says he's against torture, who is very well read, who is loved by his fellow Marines. Mm-hmm. And they're looking at a room of people, other people that Donald Trump has appointed, who do and say things each and every day that are very concerning. And they just rather not look at this history.
That's Aaron Glantz, investigative reporter at Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting. His story is called, Did Defense Secretary Nominee James Mattis Commit War Crimes in Iraq? Find a link at klw.org. Click Cross Currents. This is Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. This month, we've been airing a series of reports on care at the end of life. Our final report today looks at physician aid in dying, which took effect in California last year. The new End of Life Option Act allows terminally ill people to hasten their deaths by self-administering lethal medication. Opinion polls have shown strong support for assisted dying, which has been growing over the last few decades. Opponents like Donald Trump's Supreme Court nominee Neil Gorsuch are firmly against these laws, and Catholic church leaders and medical groups have beaten back repeated attempts to legalize aid in dying. What finally broke the logjam was a video that went viral. KALW's Joanne Marr has this report.
My name is Brittany Menard. I am 29 years old, and I am terminally ill.
Some of you may remember the story of Bay Area resident Brittany Menard. She recorded this video in October 2014, just 19 days before her death. Shortly after getting married in 2012, Brittany found out she had terminal brain cancer. She and her husband, Dan Diaz, interrupted a vacation and rushed to emergency on New Year's Eve. Here's Dan.
The headaches that Brittany was experiencing, it was clear just something was horribly wrong. And so we went to the emergency room. They did a CT scan. And that was the first time that we saw the image of a brain tumor. And it was within the following day or two that they did an MRI and they saw the size of that tumor.
Doctors told Brittany she had only 6 months left to live. Treatment options were limited. And Brittany decided to let the cancer run its course. During the first few months, she was well enough to complete everything on her wish list. Visits to Yellowstone, Glacier Point in Alaska, Olympic National Park. But Dan says time was running out.
We knew what was coming for her, and she was already suffering from pain that not even morphine could alleviate. The inability to sleep sometimes for days on end. Nausea, vomiting, the seizures were the things that terrified her the most.
But the final days and weeks were likely to be even more difficult. In the worst-case scenario, Brittany would go blind and become paralyzed as the tumor grew larger.
That was a possibility, and Brittany simply said, "I will not die that way. Why should I be forced to endure that dying process?"
Brittany decided that ending her life was the best option to achieve a gentle and quick death, before her symptoms got worse. At that time, physician-assisted dying was illegal in California, but it's been legal in Oregon since 1997. So the couple packed up their house and moved to Portland, Oregon. Brittany met all the requirements under Oregon's Death with Dignity law and was given the lethal medication to administer on her own.
I don't wake up every day and look at it. It's in a safe spot, and I know that it's there when I need it.
This was the first video Brittany released 3 weeks before her death.
And I will die upstairs in my bedroom that I share with my husband, with my mother and my husband by my side, and pass peacefully with some music that I like in the background.
In the video, she told her story about being forced to leave her home to seek physician aid in dying in Oregon.
Having to go through that process, Brittany decided that, well, if she hopes to affect change, she'll have to put herself out there. So she made that first video. At the same time, People.com, People Magazine, they released that story about her online. And within that week, 12 million views on YouTube, and Brittany Menard was all of a sudden everywhere.
After a follow-up video was released, Brittany was feeling worse and continued having seizures. So, 6 months after her cancer diagnosis, she said goodbye to her family and friends and took the lethal medication. Dan was by her side when she passed.
The secobarbital, it's powder, it's mixed with water. Upon drinking that medication, in 5 minutes, Brittany fell asleep. About 30 minutes later, as the medication is absorbed into her system, her breathing slows, and she passed away very peacefully.
The videos and Brittany's death galvanized support for the assisted dying movement in California and around the country. Backers once again introduced the Aid in Dying bill in the California State Legislature. This time, the bill passed and was signed into law by Governor Jerry Brown in October 2015.
I think it was the next day I was driving over the hill, and I realized I was about to start crying. I could feel it coming up.
Steve Hilek specializes in ethics with the San Francisco Medical Society. For the last 20 years, he's been on the front lines, lobbying for aid in dying legislation.
I pulled over and I just started sobbing, and I was shocked by myself, you know? But I realized it was all about all this work and all those people and through the years, and that somehow this had paid off after so much time and so much frustration.
For years, opponents successfully blocked efforts to legalize assisted dying. They've raised concerns over the potential for abuse. The elderly could be coerced to end their lives by greedy relatives. Disabled and poor people might hasten their deaths because they can't afford good health care. Attorney and author Wesley Smith is a leading critic of the Right to Die movement.
You consider our healthcare system with managed care, HMOs, profits being made from cutting costs. What could be cheaper than having an assisted suicide for a cancer patient rather than treating them to the end of their lives? I think the answer to assisted suicide and euthanasia has to be no.
To address these concerns, safeguards were written into the new law. Physicians must discuss alternatives to taking the drug, including comfort care, pain control, hospice and palliative care. Patients must be terminally ill and mentally competent to qualify. They must make two verbal requests for aid in dying at least 15 days apart, as well as a request in writing. Patients must consult two physicians to confirm their terminal diagnosis, and they must self-administer the medication.
That was, you know, just to make very sure that somebody really knows that this is what they want.
Healthcare ethicist Steve Hilek.
And also, the positive side effect is that you can identify problems and opportunities for giving them better care. These are the most scrutinized of all deaths, so it would be much easier if you really wanted to bump somebody off.
Dr. Lonnie Shavelson witnessed the deaths of many people ending their lives in secret during the AIDS epidemic.
About 20 years ago, what I saw was horrible. What I saw were patients taking the wrong medications at the wrong times and having bad outcomes from that.
He called these deaths dark bedroom suicides.
Nobody was providing guidance to make sure that this was being done well, done correctly, and done at the right moment or even at all. Bad outcomes included things like partial overdoses, where people would fall asleep for 2 days from an overdose of morphine that did not result in death, but resulted in brain damage, and they would wake up 2 days later sicker than they started and with even more suffering.
When physician-assisted dying became legal, he opened his new practice, Bay Area End-of-Life Options. His is the only medical practice in California focused solely on the new law and assisting qualified patients. Within days after his new business opened, he received multiple requests for help from around the state.
Many, many patients, and I mean hundreds of patients, are interested in having an aid in dying medication as one option as their death approaches, and cannot find any physician who will cooperate with them or participate with them.
All Catholic hospitals have opted out of participating for religious reasons. Many hospitals in the rural areas and the Central Valley are also opting out. But Dr. Shavelson is hopeful that as they become more familiar with the new law, more doctors and hospitals will assist patients with their aid in dying requests.
This is opening the conversation. The ability to ask for medication to end your life is saying to a doctor like, you know, if you don't take better care of me and provide a better death, I'm going to kill myself. This is what we saw in Oregon for 18 years, that there were increased conversations about good end-of-life care and not that many medications written for aid in dying. And I expect that's going to happen in California.
Well, so this is a box, a bunch of letters that people had written in support of Brittany, of my efforts, of everything that we've been doing.
Dan Diaz made a deathbed promise to his wife. that he would work on making aid in dying legal. After her death, California became the fifth state in the country to legalize physician-assisted dying. Dan now works with Compassion and Choices, an advocacy group leading the assisted dying movement. He's visited eight capitals and has shared Brittany's story with many lawmakers.
I'm immensely proud of my wife. What she would be feeling, I'm sure, is a sense of, okay, job well done. And her voice certainly did make a difference and impact for the rest of us. You know, people say, well, can one voice really make a difference? Well, yeah, hers did.
Last November, Colorado residents voted to legalize medical aid in dying. Legislation is now pending in 23 other states and Washington, D.C. For Cross Currents, I'm Joanne Marr.
That story was part of the End of Life Radio Project, supported by a grant from the Association of Healthcare Journalists and the Commonwealth Fund. You can find all four stories in the series at kalw.org. Click Cross Currents. And that's all for today's show. Our team includes Josiah Luis Alderete, Lila Day, Nina Gensler Debs, Nicole Grigg, Olivia Henry, Angela Johnston, Greer McVeigh, Ted Muldoon, Lisa Morehouse, James Rowland, Stephen Short, Judy Silber, and Andrew Stelzer. Today's show was engineered by Chris Hoff. The line producer was Hannah Kingsley Ma. Our managing editor is Jen Chien. Our managing producer is Julie Kane. Ben Trefney is our news director. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. Today's local music is by Conspiracy of Beards. They bring the sound of live choral music out of the church and into the clubs. They're appearing Sunday night at the Rickshaw Stop in San Francisco. Show starts at 9. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.
Come over. Window, my little darling. I'd like to try to read your palm. I used to think I was some kind of gypsy boy before I let you take me.
Tune into Cross Currents weekdays at 5. We've got action.
He's hoisted up by his ankles and hung upside down from the building.
Suspense.
I don't know if you heard that, but we actually just heard a smoke detector battery beep.
Romance.
Jerry, who I've been hanging out with, is my lover.
And style.
The key to his outfit is a pair of homemade AstroTurf armbands.
Kind of like so. That's my trademark, is the AstroTurf.
Not enough? We've also got penguins. Politicians.
Don't be economic, girly man.
Medical mysteries.
You would give me a pat on my belly?
Yeah, you know, protect those ovaries.
And of course, music. All that in one show. It's Cross Currents, weekdays at 5 on KALW.